Hello and welcome to Two Nerds Sitting on a Couch, in which two nerds sit on a couch and discuss science fiction and fantasy. Two Nerds Sitting on a Couch just recently watched all four Matrix movies, including the one that was just done recently. And the thing that one of the things that we talked about in regards to that movie was how Gen X it was, or how I felt it was very...
Well, I think in the sense that being self-aware and self-referential is a very Gen X thing. That kind of, like, self-aware irony.
Right.
It really, like, appeals to us for some reason.
Right. Yeah. And then also just that there's something sort of pre-9/11 about the first movie and all of mm-hmm. that. Anyway, so... kind of as a consequence, and kind of also because the fifth movie just came out, we watched the first three Scream movies. Because I remember them being just, like, 100% made out of the 90s.
Yeah.
And that is way more true than I even thought.
Yeah, I don't really even remember them. I mean, I remember... I know that I had watched the first Scream movie, but after watching... the first three of them, I definitely hadn't seen the second or third one. And it's funny because after having watched all those horror movies, I feel like I have a pretty good basis for what the movie is talking about, because it's very metatextual. I mean, it is talking about what a horror movie is and then mm-hmm. playing with that. I mean, like, there's literally a scene that goes through, like, here are the rules of a horror movie.
Yeah.
You know, and it lays them out, like, here are, you know, the three rules, you know, like, be a virgin.
Right.
And
don't drink and do drugs.
Because that's kind of like, you know, the first one only.
Right.
You know, because really, I mean, these when it gets right down to it, what the horror movies are doing are punishing adolescents. Because if you're a virgin and you don't do drugs or have sex, you're an innocent, right? So it's like babies. Like, you know. Babies are innocent. Nobody wants to kill them. Even serial killers wouldn't kill babies, right? Because it's like, they're safe. And so if you get on an airplane and there's babies, you know, it's probably not going to crash. and what horror movies are doing, and I think originally...
Pre-Scream, you mean? Because I really yes. think this changes.
Well, also pre-9/11, but I guess we'll get back to that too.
Yeah.
But like, I think, you know, when we watched all these horror movies, it really seems like it's playing on adolescents' fears of the adolescing process, you know, of puberty.
Oh, sure.
Where it's like, I want to have sex, but sex is bad, and I've been told I can't have sex because I can get diseases and babies, and you know, and I'd be a bad person, and I, you know, everybody's gonna hate me, but I really want to, and it seems really fun, and drinking is really fun, but like, you know, I don't know if I want to do it or not, and like, and there's all of these sort of fears that then it makes it very easy. You will get stabbed if you do these things, so it's okay to like feel bad about them or whatever, but it's like it's dealing with this sort of adolescent coming of age in general, because those are the rules of horror movies.
Well, and I would almost so say, I mean, because that's sort of assuming that they're, you know, that they're lens through the teenager's experience, which I don't think that's the case.
No, but
let
I mean,
me just finish, okay. Which is just that I see also some of this is just like there's that, like, when kids are like being young and optimistic and living their lives as if there won't be consequences, like, this is just an absolutely brutal, like, grown-up response. Like, yeah, actually there's consequences to, like, literally yeah. everything, because it's right. usually it, because I mean, as the third one, it makes incredibly explicit, it's always sins of the father. It's always something that happened before you were even alive.
Yeah, daddy issues. But this, I mean, I guess what I'm more mean by that is that, like, anytime anybody has sex, they get killed. Like, the person who doesn't have sex doesn't get killed because they're the hero. You know, I mean, like, that's, and that's pretty clear that right. that's, you know, this is the moralization of it. And I think that it's, while you're right, it's not through the lens of adolescence, although a lot of them are, and it's not directly at adolescence, although mm-hmm. that's a huge chunk of the consumers.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that it's a, I mean, everybody
right
has been an adolescent,
well,
who's an
I
adult,
mean,
you know, I mean, like, you've gone through it and you understand those fears and that fear of
right.
you know, I mean, like, and then the, you know, societal moralization of of the condemnation of those sins.
And I think you're right. And I think that that's definitely true in the 80s, late 70s and early 80s movies. Although yeah. I think that that really, really changes at about Scream. I think
I think 9/11 was a big, well, okay. So with Scream, I think one of the things that's really interesting about it and is different than Scream 2 and 3, at least, is that a lot of it is, there are all of these really funny little references to culture at the time. Like, mm-hmm. the one that really sticks out was when somebody just sort of offhandedly talks about, like, you know, Richard Gere and the Gerbil, which dates that movie to within a few years, because there was a very, very brief period of time when that was a thing on the, you know, nascent internet back then, you know, where it's just sort of like, you had these like sort of like me, it's like early memes where it's like, right. just these little snippets of stories that we get, whatever, like rumor.
Like, I know sort of I was told that story, and it wasn't Richard Gere, it was
Bon Jovi.
No,
that was because he had a pound of semen that he had to get pumped out of his stomach.
Oh, God, there's so much gay panic.
Yeah, there really
and
is.
Then, and there, no, it was the guy who ended up being actually gay.
Kevin Spacey.
No, oh my God, he wasn't even a thing in 1986, which I know I heard it in the sixth grade, which dates it to 1986. The Gerbil story, yeah. So that's at least 10 years before this.
Yeah. No, totally. But I mean, I think the Richard Gere and the Gerbil is like, it dates it really specifically. And then there were other things too, where it's like, somebody was like, as if, and then somebody was like, okay, Alicia, which is, you know, the reference
Alicia
to Clueless.
Silverstone, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
there's just, and the movie is just riddled with all of these references to these 90s era movies and pop culture. And that sort of like got me off on this tear about it's frustrating because we were watching this movie and we were like, I wonder what the kids would think of this. And it's like, and then we started talking about like Monty Python and how like all of the Brits are like, why, what do Americans get out of this?
You okay, know, wait, like, let's just back up just like a tiny bit and let, so 1995, right? Mm-hmm. Six?
Something like that, yeah.
96. Wes Craven's the director. So he's heavily associated with Freddy Krueger.
Yep. Well, because that's his movies.
That's all of his stuff. And he also did The Hills Have Eyes. Anyway, he's a horror director at the absolute top of his game.
Yeah.
He's got a huge career. So he's, you know, as a horror director, he can speak the language.
Yeah.
So then the guy who wrote it, and so this is the pop cultural thing, is a guy called Kevin Williamson, who was the creator of Dawson Creek.
Mm-hmm.
He also wrote a bunch of movies like I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Which were later than Scream.
They were later than Scream, but it's the same kind of, and I think he did the vampire one, Vampire Diaries. Anyway, it's a lot of this teeny bopper shit.
Yeah.
Which I love.
And I think that he's definitely got his pulse on the you know, teens of the time, which would have been us.
Right. He writes really good teens.
Yeah, but I mean, I think in particular, he like captures something of the essence of the like the thing that I think Gen Xers really dug about pop culture at the time, which was mm-hmm. a lot of self-referential, self-aware, ironic,
mm-hmm.
like pop cultural references, mm-hmm. and you know, and I do think they brought that back in the third Scream movie a little bit with the actors.
Yeah, but and that one wasn't the first two were written by him, and the next one was written by somebody else who also wrote the fourth one.
Oh, okay.
Okay, anyway, but so I'm sorry. I just wanted to, like, lay down the background before went off to the point, which is, so we got into an argument without the podcat on.
Which always happens, and it's usually during the movie, and it's like, why aren't we recording it?
But anyway, which was that, you know, you had expressed some displeasure with the like how grounded it was in the pop cultural references of
right.
the time.
Yep. And how they didn't really, because I mean, nobody ever talks about Richard Gere and the Gerbil anymore. And our kids would not have any idea A, who Richard Gere is and B, who gerbils are. And so I think that like what that means is that it makes it less relevant because, you know, somebody making a clueless joke, you know, in a movie
mm-hmm.
is not going to fly these days because it's too distant of a reference. And so it just sort of diminishes. I mean, I think the film itself is still, you know, I mean, I like Scream. I think it's a neat premise.
Mm-hmm.
It really gets at my, you know, kind of Gen X sensibilities of the, you know, self-aware irony, whatever. But I think that like the other thing I brought up was Ulysses, where it was like he was doing that on purpose. He's like, oh, the scholars are going to have a field day trying to figure out all of this shit, where he was putting in all of these references of what it meant to be a, you know, him basically,
Yeah,
like all of
no,
his personal
him.
experiences, and like, and so you would need to have his unique set of experiences, and like, and that really bugs me, and it's because it's unapproachable, and the reason is, mostly, I think, is because you have to have this enormous background in all kinds of really specific things to be able to really understand, or you'd have to do an incredible amount of research to understand all of these references and what they mean and how that affects the story. And it's like at a certain point, it's just frustrating, you know? And it's like, okay, how does this even, like, everybody's like, oh my, but I mean, he's just such a great author because of all these, you know, he's so smart and whatever. And it's like, well, except you don't actually have to be that smart to write all of that. You just have to be as smart as you are. In particular, with this, with the screen movie, a lot of those references were really dated, and it was just kind of, you know, it just sort of sparked a little Tolstoyan frustration at inaccessible art.
Right, and I guess I think that I mean I totally see like why you're bringing up them up in the same breath, like Ulysses and Scream, like I see the relationship, but I do think it's kind of they're not using pulp culture in the same way
No.
at
Yeah.
all. Like
No, I mean.
the Scream movie is using pop culture to absolutely position itself as a member, like you, the audience is in the same waters with it. Like it is speaking the language of the people at the moment, at the time. And obviously, 25 years later, we can still watch it and it's fine because
Well,
we
because
were
we're
there
of
at the
that time,
time.
yeah.
Absolutely. But at the time, it was cutting edge relevant in terms of like slang, pop cultural references, all of that stuff. Like the way they talk to each other. Like felt really naturalistic on set. I mean,
Yeah. Well, and I
like
think that's
naturalistic in
the
the way television is.
right. And I think that's part of like why I think that it was groundbreaking for the era, because this is about when movies started to heavily reference pop culture in that way, and it was really cool to, because I don't think movies really did that up to that point. Like, they wouldn't necessarily reference some sort of contemporary reference because, you know, whatever, the directors wanted to be more timeless or
Well,
whatever.
and it
And in the
was
90s they were like, fuck timeless, this is now, and we're
right.
gonna like do this now. And that happens in like local plays all the time, where they like insert local politician name here for laughs, and it's a great way to sort of relate to your crowd more immediately, and they just did it in the movie.
And I mean, this is just a not very interesting pet theory of mine, but I think that often horror and comedy work much better is they're trying to be as current as possible. You know, like I mean, I think that there's a sort of sense that the goal of all art should be to, you know, stay fresh and timeless and whatever, and that can absolutely be a
A
goal.
goal,
It could be a goal, but I think that some things, it's so much better if you're not aiming that direction, you
Right. Or
know?
it doesn't matter, because like Monty Python, I can still really think it's hilarious and get a lot out of it without having gone to an English public school, you know,
In
like
the 60, I'm
it,
sorry,
as a
in the
boy.
50s.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so it's like, I mean, you don't necessarily have to have a full grounding, and I mean, yeah, you're gonna miss a lot of the references, but ultimately, is it still good? Yeah. I mean, it's still enjoyable. You still get something out of it. So sure, why not? It doesn't really matter that much. But I think that like, to sort of get back to the self-referential, self-aware part, where it's like, you know, one of the things I really liked about the movie is that they talk about movies a lot.
A
You know, I mean,
lot.
it's all about the horror movie, and like, and yelling at the horror movie, like, oh my God, who would act like that? Don't be so stupid. Like, all of that stuff gets acted out in the movie itself, and yet it's still a horror movie. You know, it still happens. And there's the, you know, the, what they do at the end ends up being sort of a surprise twist, you know, to be able to
You mean at the
cover.
third one
No, I mean, even in the
at the end?
first, you know, because it's like, oh, haha, there's not just one killer. And it's like, because that's how they can throw you off the scent for most of the movie. So it's really just, I mean, because that's what horror movies are, is just like hiding a football for the whole time. And if you're Halloween, you just keep hiding the football, you know, forever. There's no, I mean, you never even have to show the football, and it's
Doesn't
still
matter.
awesome,
You
you
know what?
know?
The football doesn't. There is no spoon. the cake is a lie.
Yeah, like, there's who no cares football. About motivation? You're here to get jump scares, and you get them.
And that was actually a really wonderful thing we got said, especially in the first one, that was mm-hmm. very loud, is like, you know, he's like, ha-ha, what's my motivation? He's like, it's the turn of the millennium. I don't need a motivation.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of sort of millennial, and I'm using that in the old lowercase m sense, there was a lot of millennial panic there. About yeah. like what was coming, like you know, the opening scene with what's her face, the blonde,
Drew Barrymore.
Oh yeah. My god, who did a ton of like horror when she was a kid.
Yeah.
Anyway, that opening scene, which is like by itself, just kind of a lovely little short film.
Mm-hmm.
Like she, God, where was I going with this?
Pop cultural self-reference.
Self-referencing Drew Barrymore.
I mean, it was just like the scene in Halloween 20 where Jamie Lee Curtis shows up for the first scene to just get killed. I mean, that's what that Drew Barrymore scene felt like. It was like a little vignette,
a little
set piece that she could just do that sort of lay out the... It's almost like a movie in a movie where it sort of lays out the premise of horror movies so that you can then take it apart later.
And I think that actually that opening sequence is super well done. Like mm-hmm. the fact that it starts out relatively lighthearted and she's sort of talking about movies and not really, you know, and there's this, I know where I was going. It was the intrusive technology of the cell phone. Like the first one, like cell phones were very new. Very, 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 right. very new. I mean,
because
in
this
95.
Is the call is coming from inside the house, you know.
Literally, like, yeah.
And in fact, all of the movies feature landlines.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing that sort of changed in the 2000s.
But they start introducing like the Star 6-9 and the, you know, like they start actually as the technology updates, the films update along with it.
Yeah, because the whole premise of the Scream series is what would a normal rational person do in these situations?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's the thing about it is that horror movies are by their very nature unrealistic. Like those things wouldn't happen, and if they did, they wouldn't happen that way, and if they did happen that way, people would survive, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. it's like the whole thing wouldn't be as scary as it is, and it would all end pretty well, but then you wouldn't have a movie, you know. And so mm-hmm. like the movies are there to sort of deconstruct that silliness, the mm-hmm. artifice of it, because why are we really here? We're here to see people get stabbed, you know. We're here to see, like, you know, people get shocked and surprised and jump scared. And that's it.
Right. And yeah, really. And just, well, I mean, and...
I mean, unless it's more of a cerebral horror. But that, you know, and then by sort of, you know, meta-textualizing the whole thing, now all of a sudden we're looking at the movie, looking at itself.
Oh, my God. Okay, so the first one is incredibly meta-textual. Like, they have, they make reference to, like, roughly 1 million horror films.
Yeah.
In fact...
Like, to bolster the rules of the horror films.
Right. Halloween is playing in the background, the whole party. Yep.
Nosferatu shows up at some point. Well, and that's the first thing that the phone call with Drew Barrymore and the killer is what's your favorite horror movie?
Right.
And she says Halloween, and she says, what's your favorite horror movie? And he's like, why don't you guess? And she says, I bet it's Nightmare on Elm Street.
Right.
And you know, so the whole audience kind of giggles to itself,
yeah.
knowing that that's a Wes Craven movie. And that it wasn't the, you know, her favorite. It's just the, mm-hmm. This is the second best.
Right.
But it's just him patting himself on the back. Oh, yeah. I almost broke my arm
and
there.
He shows up in a cameo dressed like Freddy Krueger.
As a school janitor.
And as a school janitor.
Yeah.
Which was just like, I completely lost my shit at that point. Because I had completely missed that cameo at the time.
Yeah. Well, and it just seems sort of funny because it's like, you know, the Fonz, who is the you know, Henry Winkler is the mm-hmm. is the school principal, ends up not even really being credited, which is kind of funny. He's got this kind of which is sort of funny. And then, like, randomly getting killed for no really good reason. It doesn't make any sense. But I guess, you know, at the end, we realize that they tell us that there is no motive. It's just because they're psychotic. And that's the thing I couldn't quite get. It's like, even knowing going into it that it was the, you know, the two buddies, mm-hmm. One of them kills the other one's girlfriend, comes in, sort of nods at him, and is like, hey, almost to say, yeah, okay, I just killed your girlfriend.
Right.
You know, and then you almost get the sense that the other one is kind of mad that he doesn't get to kill the other guy's girlfriend, because it's like, I mean, tradesies.
Tradesies, yeah. I mean, I killed your girlfriend for you.
Yeah, well, and it's like, what would be the motivation of that? It doesn't make any sense. And that's the whole thing, where it's just like, none of these movies have any real motivation. None of them make any sense. And the more you try to make sense of them, the stupider they get. And then you need to, like, start talking about how stupid they are in the movie because it's so stupid.
Yeah, I know. But I do kind of dig it, though, because there is, like, I mean, because this goes on and on, like, what's the motivation? And then, you know, because he says, I have no motivation. And then he's like, well, it's because your mom fucked my dad. And right. Then my mom left me, which is weak as fuck.
Yeah.
And not very good. And that may be a motivation for him. But Matthew Lillard,
yeah,
literally has none. It's just, yeah. He's just psychotic, which I actually, I mean, I like the line of, you know, it's the turn of the millennium. Nobody needs motivations anymore. Feels really accurate.
Right. Fin de siècle. That's the French term for like that whole like end of times.
Fin de millennium.
Yeah. I mean, it's like this end of times sort of euphoric despair, you know, I mean, where everybody was kind of worried about it because it's like, I mean, this is a big deal. And it turns out we were all worried about something that we had no idea was coming, but we all felt it. Right. I mean, that was the cusp of the internet revolution.
We weren't wrong.
I mean, like, and there was an enormous change in 9/11. I mean, you know, after the internet revolution, and it was a really, you know, it was a big, actually back then we did have a sense that it was like, you know, climate change was, I mean, because we've known about that for, you know, hundreds of years.
I reread, Ursula Le Guin's, the one with George Orr. The Lathe of Heaven recently. She's worried about that then. She wrote it in 1963. She's totally worried about it.
I mean, they knew about that in like the 1800s where they talked about all this coal smoke is eventually going to kill us all. You know, they knew.
They weren't not wrong.
But the other interesting thing, just to like jump back to the Drew Barrymore scene real quick, is that like when she's on the phone, she's in this like modern America house that's a fishbowl. I mean, it's all windows, no curtains, and there's like a pool outside, whatever, because we have this sense as middle class or upper middle class white people that we don't care that the world is watching us, but it's kind of perfect for this movie because it sort of implies that we're on the other side of that glass looking in.
Yeah,
like we're watching with
the
killer's eyes, you know, I mean, and we're being rewarded by seeing the killer, you know, and she's not safe. Those are just, I mean, it makes you realize that windows are a really easy way into a house. You can just throw a rock through it and then climb. I mean, it's like, we're not all that safe in houses.
I mean, and
locking doors is not helpful.
The ghost-faced killer people go through glass constantly.
All the time.
It is not a barrier.
Well, except for one of the later, I think it was the second movie where she's in like some sort of soundproof booth, and part of the soundproofing is these like apparently indestructible glass that even pounding on it, you can't hear it on the other side.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like,
that
so they try
nice
to break
touch.
The window and it just never breaks.
It was a nice touch.
Yeah.
And it worked because up until that scene, glass was not a barrier.
Well, and that's something that I think is kind of cool about these movies is that, so the second movie is the sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably should have been called Scream 2, : the sequel, because you get the same group of people talking about the same, well, the ones who were left anyway, talking about movies.
Yep.
And, you know, you come out with the rules for the sequel. You know,
right.
If you're in a sequel, there's,
higher body count, more gore, true, because there was that one scene where I was like, ugh, that was a little too much even. And then the sad thing is, he's going to say, you got to do this one thing if you're going to survive. And then somebody interrupts him and then he skips it.
Right.
Which I thought
was
cute.
Really know. Yep.
They're welcome to the football. We're going to put that away.
So you have all these things happen in the first movie and they start getting echoed in the second movie where like there's a scene where Sydney punches Gail in the first scene or the first movie where it's like, you know, where we find out that she wrote a book about her mother. Like, capitalized on the whole thing. So there's some bad blood there. And so she punches her on camera. And then in this second movie, that scene gets reenacted again. You know, where we're like, we're going to punch you again. And then in the third movie, it's Gail punching...
The person who plays Gail.
It was her protege.
Wasn't it?
Oh, my God. Now I don't remember.
I think it was.
Yeah.
I think it was.
Oh, yeah. No, it was.
Because she's like... I'm going to talk to my...
my lawyer's going to love it. Oh, yeah, that's right. It was totally the person playing her in the movie, which was supposed to be, like, Jennifer...
That was... Yeah.
Aniston or...
Yeah, one of the two.
Yeah, I mean, they had, like... It was, like, Jennifer, Tom, and Angelina
were the
actors
just,
in the movie, and it was like, this is pretty funny. But, I mean, the one thing that they got right with the sequel, I think, is that Because one of the things they joked about is like, okay, name a movie where the sequel was better. Yeah. And they were like, oh, what about this? What about Aliens? Get away from her, you bitch. And it was like, I think it was Stay Away from Her, you bitch. And then so they start like getting geeking out about movies, which right. is another thing that I love about that
these movie. Yeah.
But it also had all of these people in it from the 90s television that like suddenly seems like an all-star studded cast to me.
I think even...
Because it's like, you know, you've got Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Even at the time, I think...
Liv Schreiber.
Yeah.
And, you know...
O'Connell, Jerry O'Connell.
Luke Wilson.
And they got Tori Spelling
because they made a joke in the first movie about Tori Spelling playing her in the movie. And then they did it, which is just funny as hell to me.
Yeah.
As a Gen Xer.
I mean, and I think that's the thing, is it, I mean, it definitely is playing to our sense, our like kind of generational sensibilities, and good, goddamn job, I guess.
And a lot of it is just the kind of the self-aware irony of all of it, you know, mm-hmm. it's just like the disbelief that you could actually get John Malkovich in the movie playing John Malkovich.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, that's just it. That's so amazing for us because we really love our irony. And I think that's one of the things that changed after 9/11. And we've talked about this, where mm-hmm. it's like, that's kind of the death of irony. Like, you couldn't really, you know, everybody sort of gave up on being ironic because at that point there was no, it wasn't funny anymore. It crushed our souls a little bit as like generationally. And then now all of a sudden it seems like it's coming back. It's okay to be
right.
like self-aware and ironic again. But
I do have to say that I think the other, like 9/11 is a big deal. Obviously that's like the watershed,
mm-hmm.
but I think in terms of like youth culture and films set up with, you know, high school age children,
mm-hmm.
Columbine was the thing that did it in, you know, yeah, what I mean?
That's true too.
Because you think about going back, when you go back and watch a movie like Heathers.
Yeah, that one really aged like milk.
Nothing flies anymore in that. I mean, no, it didn't age like. I mean, I think the parts of that film are still quite funny. It's just
but you can't just like blow up a school and have that be the heroic.
Or the fact that he pulls out a gun in the lunchroom. It's got blanks in it, quote.
Right.
And shoots the guy, and he's like suspended. I'm like, the FBI would take him, and he would be, you know, out like. I mean, there's things that just like, I felt like a lot of the stuff in this movie felt very like quaint and naive. Adorable. Well, about the way social violence is enacted, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, obviously it hadn't happened yet, but I thought it was really interesting to have, you have a pair of killers who are like the Columbine killers, where you have the one with the motivation and the other one who's just kind of following along.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that was kind of the dynamic between the two of them, right? Dylan right. and can't remember the other guy's name. Doesn't matter. But you know, and saying that they don't really have a motivation is kind of accurate. Like,
yeah,
I mean, Columbine, they had motivations, quote, but they weren't.
I mean, it's, I guess they're not
they're not very articulatable, though. Like, I can't really. I mean, I could probably say some pop psych nonsense, but it's not like they had a manifesto, man. They just killed their classmates because they wanted to. And so, I mean, I think that Scream is really prescient in that regard.
They were planning on getting out of it.
No. I mean, well, they didn't.
But actually, that's one of the things they talk about in the Scream movies is, especially the second one, the sequel, they're talking about, you know, do movies create violence? And it's like, you know, and that was a big thing at the time, like, you know, oh, we should ban violent video games because it causes everybody to mm-hmm. be more violent. It's like, mm-hmm. there's no correlation there. People are just psychotic. Like, the movies aren't making them psychotic. They're just giving them a playbook for their psychosis. But, you know, that dude who shot Reagan did it for Jodie Foster.
Right. It wasn't Jodie's fault. Stupid, yeah, you know? No, it's not. Well, I mean, and I think that these Scream movies get more and more explicit about their rejection of that idea.
Yeah. Like, well, what was it? I think it was the sequel that starts with a black couple in line to see the movie Stab, which is based on the book by Gail... self-referential of the self-referential movie.
It's the in-universe Scream franchise. It's called Stab.
Yeah, which is, you know, so you're in this theater full of people wearing the masks
and they have glow-in-the-dark knives.
And so, like, you have it all set up for, like, somebody to actually kill somebody there and have everybody think that it's marketing, which is what ends up happening, you know? And that's sort of, like, you know, and they even have a conversation on the way in about how, like, these movies are white.
Yeah.
They're so white. Black people are never in these movies. And if they are, they're dead really quickly. And the movie ended up having more black people in it. Actually, right. Any black people at all, because the first movie was really white.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I thought that opening scene, because the opening scene has Omar Epps, who isn't even credited. I don't even think he'd done anything yet. Omar Epps and Jada Pinkett.
Not Smith yet.
Well, because it was Courtney Cox, not Courtney Cox or Arquette
until the third one.
Then she was an Arquette.
Courtney Cox or Arquette.
Anyway, so it's the two of them. They come in. They're going to see this movie. She's like, I want to go see the Sandra Bullock movie. He's like, that's white as shit too.
Yeah.
She's like, but whatever. Fine, let's go. So they go and he's stabbed in the bathroom. And then the killer, I mean, I thought this is all very Halloween. I think that they make some reference to, like, the fact that, like, at one point there's a sheet on him, which is what Myers does. Anyway, it doesn't matter. In this scene, you know, he goes in and sits next to her. The whole, like, audience is being the worst audience in the world. They're howling. They're jumping around.
Mm-hmm.
And they're mostly white. And, you know, so then he picks her up and starts stabbing her to death in a room full of people. And I was like, you could actually read this as, like, the black experience of public violence is mm-hmm. that they are regularly treated violently, like, in public, and everybody just stands around watching it happen.
Yeah. But as the opening set piece,
mm-hmm.
it makes absolutely no sense in the movie whatsoever. No. Once you find out who the killers are, you're like, why would they bother killing this black couple in this white-ass theater? You know, I mean, like, actually, there were a couple of other black people in the theater, but, like, you know.
Still.
I mean, it makes no sense. But whatever. It doesn't matter, because at that point, we're opening the film with a bit of you know, let's talk about horror films.
Yeah.
Because we're in one, and then let's you know, be over the top about the horror of it, and then let's start the movie.
Right. And those opening set pieces are more or less related to the rest of the film. Because, you know, I mean, I'm a little hazy on why they even killed Drew Barrymore in the first place.
Yeah, I mean the whole thing is just to be a set piece, because that's how you start a horror movie. You know? I mean, like, how else are you going to start it with horror other than that? But then, so the second movie is, like, they're in college now, and they're so they're going through trying to, like, have it relate to the first movie in a lot of ways, because, or, you know, twist it slightly, because it's like the sequel. Mm-hmm. And you need to do the same thing, because, well, let's be realistic here.
That's why we watched the first one.
Was a success, which is why we have a second movie.
Right.
So let's just do all the same stuff, but not being boring. So let's try and put little twists on it
is fine. It was Wes Craven. He'd already done 8 million. Like, he knows from sequels. Like, he's done a million of them.
Yep.
And so, you know,
I mean, like, they laid out the rules at the beginning of the sequel. Like, there was going to be more blood.
Being able to articulate
more corpses,
that, he's going to be able to do it.
And the only way you can survive is if...
interrupt you.
So, yeah, I mean, so she's at college now. She's got a new boyfriend who is
Jerry O'Connell.
Guy from Sliders.
Yeah.
And then a tiny baby Timothy Oliphant.
Who has just
the most 90s-est hair.
I just wanted to go and just rub his head like a troll doll.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
And you could tell that, like, they had set up these two guys, her boyfriend and his friend, to be the killers.
Yeah.
Only...
because they were echoes of her boyfriend and his friend, who were the killers.
Right.
I mean, in fact, Oliphant is kind of trying to be Matthew Lillard a little bit.
Yeah, well, and we find out later that that's almost on purpose.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, his motivation was
I can't remember.
It was his mother, or his father, who had slept with her mother, was
no,
it?
No, that was
it
the
was the other
first
it was the
movie.
Other way around. Was it?
That's the first movie.
Oh no, he had a motivation.
I honestly don't know what it was. It slides away.
It was similar,
but
different. Anyway.
No. That one, I think he was just a psycho, because it's the mom who's the real brains behind the operation.
Oh, that's right. She found him on a internet site for psycho killers.
Yeah. Okay, there you go. That
okay,
makes sense.
So he didn't. So he did. He actually was a psycho, like Matthew Lillard. So like same.
Yeah,
but then, I mean, obviously the twist here is that it's the mother, because they talk about that in the, you know, answer
very
our question and
first movie.
If you get it right, you know, who was the killer in Friday the 13th? And it's like, no, it was Jason's mother.
Right.
You know, so
Mrs. Voorhees.
You're wrong. So it turns out that, and actually this is, so because I hadn't seen these movies, it was like, let's try and call it, right? So what is it with this Gail protege running around like, oh my God, I read your book. I want to be an investigative reporter.
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
I feel like this is going to be her.
Right.
Just because that would be the twistiest twist ever. Because it's like, they even mention at one point that it's like, you know, you have to shake it up. It doesn't have to be a dude even.
Right. Because he points out that most serial killers are dudes.
Yeah. So at that point, it's, you know.
Yeah. So it's like,
why not her?
Here we go.
But I didn't, I actually, I mean, I guess I thought it was going to be Timothy Oliphant and the boyfriend, Jerry.
O'Connell.
But when he ends up getting killed, you're like, oh, well.
Yeah.
I guess he wasn't the partner then.
I really believe that I've seen these movies because I knew it wasn't Jerry O'Connell. I couldn't, and I was suspicious that it was the mom, but I couldn't remember anything.
Right. Well, and that was one of those, like, you know, football, unhidden. So like now all of a sudden here's your twist. And then it's just a, you know, how do we shoot these people while plausibly keeping all of our cast
favorite
members
alive
for,
yeah,
the you know, the trilogy.
I've been actually kind of surprised at how durable Courtney Cox, David Arquette, and Sydney Aguette. That's fine, but
yeah.
What's her face?
But David Arquette was getting the like top billing in these.
Was it the third one?
And third one, he got top billing.
I kind of wonder. So
because there's so many Arquettes in this, it makes you wonder if it's not really an Arquette production.
Well,
somehow.
I mean, that's what I was wondering. Is it like when the first one was made, Friends was already on the air? Like a lot of these people had success already. These are not unknowns. I mean, they weren't like huge names, but they were like absolutely pretty big deals in television. You
right.
know, the Party of Five was a thing.
Friends
was a thing.
Because they make a joke about how like David Schwimmer was playing.
Right,
like...
right.
And, and it's like, why would you get that unless you actually knew something about 90s era television?
Right. But and Sarah Michelle Gellar was already Buffy. You know, Jerry O'Connell was already doing Sliders. Like all of these people are coming from they're already in things.
Pacey
like,
showed up.
He
was just a student, though. He wasn't really in the
movie. I don't think that was on the air yet.
Oh, interesting.
Because I think that Scream was Williamson. Is that his name? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Williamson. I think it's his first movie.
Oh.
Or very close to first movie. And he hadn't gone on to do television yet. Anyway, but I kind of wonder if she wasn't a producer on that thing, on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's possible.
Because David Arquette weren't married yet, but they might have already been dating.
Yeah, well, they've definitely, you know, were in these movies together for a long time.
Right. Well, for sure they were married by the third.
Right. Well, so the third movie is like you have this posthumous recording from the film nerd who is like, obviously he's like, if you're watching this, I'm dead. And that means that, you know, I need to give you the rules for, because if it's a trilogy,
movie. All
bets are off.
Mm-hmm.
That means... It could be supernatural, and you know, the killer can't be killed.
He's unkillable, yeah.
Or, and, like, everything you thought you knew about your past is wrong. Or, you know, the new evidence will come to light, and whatever. And basically, like, laying out, here's what, you know, we're going to tell
you. Here's what we're going to do.
And she, like, in the second movie, she actually is in a stage production as Cassandra, which is kind of funny because it's like, you know, let me tell you what's going to happen. And then everybody does it all anyway, you know,
yeah,
and it's
yeah,
just
yeah.
like, okay. So the trilogy is setting itself up to be, I mean, they're coming out and saying like, you know, even Sydney could die. Like, you don't know if it's a trilogy, whatever. And then by the point, like they go into like the whatever records department and there's like Carrie Fisher sitting there.
Carrie Fisher
and
is
they're
the
like,
records
oh
keeper.
Oh my God, you look just like, she's like, I know. And there's a picture of Carrie Fisher on the wall.
And she's there smoking and looking
and
just
like
Carrie Fisher.
You know, I know exactly who I look like. Do you want me to tell you who you look like? You know, so she's just like this kind of bitchy whatever. And at that point, it like totally plants the seed in my head that this is going to be like it's going to be her long lost brother.
Yes.
Right? It's going to be a sibling thing.
Yeah.
And it turns out that her boyfriend is really her brother or something. somehow her brother is going to be the killer, and it's going to be like, for whatever reason, and then like as the plot unfolds, it's like, oh, I can kind of piece together now, like her mom disappeared for 2 years. Like, how did we not know this? Well, it just was never, it never came up. Weird. It turns out she was an actress on this same production. Weird. Yeah. Boy, that's really strange, you know? So it's like, you just sort of piece it together and it's like, oh, you know, I figured out the plot. I had the wrong guy.
Completely. But you had the absolutely the plot right, all worked out. Right, the plot was absolutely correct. It's just the guy was wrong, which is fine.
And some of the details about how it meshes with the first movie, because it's like, well, what happened was he filmed the actual affair, showed it to the kid, and gave him the motivation to kill her in the first place, because he had already admitted to killing her, but it was really directed by the director. Guy. And I don't know, I have a feeling...
Let me write about a writer. Well, he even
says, like, I'm a director.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, you had mentioned at one point that they had different scripts to keep everybody from knowing how it ended, because, like, something about Scream 2, like, they...
Scream 2, I think that the killers were revealed somehow. Like, before it came out, whatever.
So they were trying to hide it, so they had different versions of the script. And I almost think that it was, like, you know, like Clue, because up until the end, it could have been any one of several different people. Like, I was really liking... the Angelina character, the real skinny, short-haired pixie girl, because there was like sort of an offhand comment about how, like, well, how'd you get all the way over there? And it's like, well, if she was the killer, then, you know,
that's she would have been over there.
The explosion. And then I was liking the cop, because he had a file on her and talked about his past with Hollywood and how he was born and raised. He was actually the better choice there.
I think
and the more obvious.
The thing is that I think Patrick Dempsey is a better actor than the guy who was actually the killer is the problem. Yeah,
no, that's
true. I mean,
true.
He's, you know, I think he's actually kind of okay. Yeah. But he can do kind of like weird menace pretty well. For somebody as like matinee idol good looking as him.
Oh, yeah. And then they get Lance Henriksen to play the, you know, Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, my God.
Like, they even talk about the whole, like, you know, kind of, if he invites you to the private party at the Four Seasons, don't go. You know, like, that whole, the whole thing where it's, you know, they almost make reference to, you know, these actresses going in.
Okay.
Because he hosts parties where these actresses go in and get taken advantage of, because it's like they're buying their way into the industry.
Right.
And kind of saying, and this is a Weinstein production. Like,
was
just
this
saying,
movie though?
Yeah, they all of them were, and they just say it out loud.
Oh my God,
it's so weird.
It's so much worse than I thought.
Speaking of self-referential,
because Rose McGowan, who is the best friend in the first Scream movie, and she's killed. This is the period when Harvey Weinstein raped her.
Yeah,
this is exactly the time period, and so. That's actually astonishingly awful.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, to have the second movie then talking about how white the first movie is, and like, and actually having a slightly more diverse cast, and then the third movie to actually talk about the industry and how, you know, completely destructive it is. I mean, I don't know how they got that past the, you know, I mean, it was sort of watered down enough that if you were a Weinstein, you could be like, oh, this is sort of the open secret in our industry, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, they kind of imply that that's what was going on, and it was. And it was so much worse than the genteel way they were describing it, but it's like, that would have been motivation. But I think that, like, because that would have been the other thing is, like, if he were, because I was kind of thinking maybe Lance Henriksen is the father of Neve Campbell and the brother, right?
No, because... it's just the brother.
No, I know, but I mean, like, that would have been the other plot line that they could have developed if they wanted to go that direction. There would have been a whole other plot in there. So, I mean, they almost could have had, like, multiple endings, because at the third act turn, at that point, it could have been any of those plausibly. It could have been any of those, and I'm liking a lot of the stories that I've invented for why it could have been them.
I mean, when I was just looking this up, there is an alternate ending for, I think, Scream 2.
Oh, funny.
So, I mean, I think you may be. I mean, it's probably one of those things where they shot several. I mean, they've done this.
But it would have been neat if, like with Clue, when they released it in the theaters, they actually showed different endings at different times, so that people talking about the movie would be confused.
I remember when it came out, and I was hanging out with friends of mine, and they were like bound and determined to see every single version of that. And,
which I'm glad and, when like, they released in the it, they theater, actually like
trying to figure out which ones it was. And anyway, it's pretty funny.
Yeah, which I mean would be a pretty neat way to do the movie is to like have actual alternate endings of it, because that would be kind of a self referential thing for it.
Yeah,
we should hit up
YouTube. I'm sure it's out there somewhere.
Yeah, but anyway, so I mean, I think they ended up fulfilling the promise of the trilogy, and I love the fact that they had Carrie Fisher in there. That was just
best
cameo I feel like I've seen and like, all year.
Like throwing her in there just absolutely makes like that's the moment where you were like it crystallized the like I know what they're doing now. I know exactly what they're doing.
Well,
now.
She even makes an offhand comment of like, you know, it was up between me and Carrie Fisher, and the one who got it was the one who slept with George Lucas.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa.
Yeah, no, that's so gross. Anyway, what was I gonna say? Yeah, I mean the Weinstein stuff and the kind of rape stuff is pretty alarming, actually, when you get right down to it, because it's like it's an indictment of Hollywood, and it's not indicting the art that's, you know, it's not indicting the meat that gets made. It's indicting the grinder.
Yeah.
You know, right. Like it is nasty, and there's all kinds of like unfair violent bullshit that goes on behind the scenes.
Well, and so many people apologize for it because they are like, well, this is the system, and you have to work within the system. This is what we've got, you know, and it's like sort of saying that the corruption is the only way it can ever be. And it's like, no, I mean, if you stand up and fight against it, maybe you could get the Weinstein thrown in jail.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, I'm glad that eventually happened.
Yeah.
Because how many people has he completely destroyed?
I don't think
in his career.
I don't
you
think
know?
It's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. And that's just, I don't know. I mean, and to have the movie actually like talk about it way back then.
Way
is
back.
Just.
But I feel like, unfortunately, a lot of this stuff is open secret. I mean, I remember reading blind items about Louis C.K. and pretty much kind of knowing that it was Louis C.K. years before the allegations made out, you know, in public. Like, there's a lot. I mean, and I'm some nobody in Minnesota.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm nobody.
Right.
I have no ties to the industry. Yeah. And if I know, then fucking everyone does.
Yeah. But I really like, though, that the premise of the third movie was being more metatextual about the movie industry itself, and not just the fact that it's a trilogy, and here's what it means to be a trilogy. They're actually on set. They had to build a set of the set.
Oh, my God.
And like, and work through it, you know, and it's like, so this is a movie about making horror movies.
Yeah.
Which is really, that's a really interesting twist on it. So I haven't seen the fourth one yet, and I'm really curious where they're going to go, you know, with
because
that and then the fifth.
It's written by the same person as the third. So,
oh, okay.
So, you know, we can look forward to the same kind of.
Because with the fourth, it's almost a reboot at that point. And like,
because that was the thing. So, okay. So it's like 96, 97 are Scream 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is slightly later in 2000, but they're all solidly before the turn of the millennium.
Yep.
And then 4 comes out in 2011.
Oh.
And 5 is now, you know, 2022.
Wow. So Scream 4 was a 9/11 movie. Like, that came out that year.
No, 2011, not 2001.
9/11 is 2000.
It happened in 2001.
Oh, right. I for some reason I was like, the 11 is 2011. It's like no, that's the month.
That's the month. Yeah, you were correct. That's right. Yeah. So, you know, so there's big gaps there, but I think it's interesting because it is like, you know, I mean, the fourth movie in any given, you know, series is a little like, really? Because,
well, and maybe they had to wait 10 years before they could get irony back enough to make that movie.
I think that's absolutely true. I think that's 100% true.
Because, I mean, I don't know, like, there was a good chunk of time where nobody really wanted anything that resembled navel gazing, you know?
No, right. Like, and, yeah, and just that whole, I mean, and there's like an almost, this is a weird thing to say, but there's an almost lightheartedness to the violence. Like, you know, it's gotten so self-referential and so meta and so, you know, kind of deliberately aggressively fictional, mm-hmm. that you don't have to worry and you don't have to be upset. I mean, because, yeah. you know, we were kind of arguing about, like, I mean, absolutely by the third, it's a horror comedy. Right. It's more comedy than horror.
Right.
But I think, I mean, the first one, it is trying to be a horror film. It has moments yeah. of levity. But I think that what you're sort of reacting to, what we're sort of reacting to, is that it's really hard to get emotionally invested in characters who keep calling attention to their fictionality.
Yeah, well, and I definitely think that it's a comedy series.
Yes.
I mean, that's what's yeah. really happening here. But, and I was speaking of comedies, there was the movie that came out, Scary Movie, that was making fun of this movie.
There's like 800 of those.
Which now. I think is kind of funny, because it's like a movie that is parodying a self-referential, self-aware movie.
Right.
Which is just sort of, but you know.
I mean, I said this earlier.
It just gets silly at a certain point.
I said this earlier when we didn't have the podcast on, but like, you know, when our kid was like 5, 6, he would watch things and he'd be like, the references, because anytime he understood that there was like a cultural, you know, like when people would make whatever, once he started being able to identify those things, he was just like so pleased with himself. Right.
Yeah.
And he called them the references.
The references.
And that's what made things good for him. And I would be like, just because something references something doesn't mean they're doing anything interesting with it. They're just yeah. making reference,
I mean,
to it.
But that's the thing about, like, you know, iconic stuff. And this is like, you know, in art history, you would have artists using iconography that today would have to be explained to you. But at the time, everybody just sort of understood that when you have this particular object or this particular, you know, with this person, it means that this person is this saint that represents this. So it's like you're pulling in these things that tell a bigger story in a shorthand that everybody would understand. Mm-hmm. And that's how they used it. It was like Legos, where like you would build these pieces and they would lock together to create a bigger story. So you didn't actually have to do as much work with your painting to get the background of it. Like, you could just have your subject matter and then all of this kind of iconography that then explains the context of it. And that's kind of what these references are in a lot, like in the later movies anyway. Right. When they talk about other horror movies, they're telling you what this movie is about and they're giving you the context to put it in.
Oh no, I completely agreed. I was slagging on the Scary Movies. Like, yeah, those are just 8,000 references which aren't saying anything about anything.
Right.
They're just
it's like
meaningless.
Each one of those, it's like watching a whole series of barely connected Saturday Night Live skits. I mean, you could watch,
and like 90s era ones, and they were bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the whole thing just sort of, yeah, it's, I guess, entertaining if you're really super stoned. And that's what those movies are for, you know?
Yeah, no, and that's fine. I remember I had a guy I worked with who was from Eastern Europe, and he thought those were just the absolute height of culture. He loved those movies so much.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But yeah, I think that like, the whole Scream series, it held up a lot better.
Oh my God.
You know, I mean, than a lot of movies do. And I'm glad that I watched it again, because I would definitely watch the series again at some point, because I have a feeling that I would, now that I've sort of talked through my feelings about it, like,
yeah.
I mean, I think they are actually really good horror movies, and I really, really dig the way that they are self-aware and talk about horror movies, and they talk about how to make horror movies. So, you know, definitely rewatchable.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, I knew I liked it at the time. That doesn't necessarily mean anything, because younger me can be an idiot about stuff. But like...
Well, and also times have changed enough that we can be horrified by stuff that we used to gloss over.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was talking to about it. It was like, you remember when Clinton and Monica Lewinsky happened? Why wasn't I more upset about that?
Yeah.
That's pretty upsetting.
Yeah.
Anyway, so... But yeah, but I was pleasantly surprised, not just by the first one, but all three of them. I thought were completely cromulent. I thought that they did really interesting things, and because, you know, you were talking about the cultural Legos that we all sort of have a similar set of cultural Legos that you know you can use and point things out, and you know, I get really irritated with you know, when people are clumsy, just using the reference doesn't mean you're using it well.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like when you get to the end of a film and suddenly all this Christ imagery shows up and that person gets to be the hero and Jesus Christ. And it's like, come on, Do better. You can't just point out that there's Jesus iconography and then that will make that stand up on its own. It doesn't.
Right.
You know, you actually have to nail them to the fucking cross.
Right. Right? Well, I mean, because that stuff is supposed to just be context. It's not supposed to be content.
Right. Right. And so that's something, I mean, that's something that I kept noticing in like the Halloween movie, the later ones that got bad.
Yeah.
Is that they would get to the end and there would be this, you are a voyeur, and you know, it's the art, you know, like your consumption of this kind of violence is what causes the violence, blah blah blah. And it's this clumsy bullshit like justification for itself, like it's like a Victorian moral like tacked on the end,
right?
And like I was a little worried that they were going to go that way with this, like, you know, with their treatment of the reporter and stuff,
right?
That's not where they went.
No,
at all. Like they didn't go anywhere near that, which I think is frankly astonishing. I mean,
yeah.
Good fucking job, man.
Yeah.
Loving it.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, apparently I'm still susceptible to all the things that Xers are susceptible to.
As an Xer, I approve.
All right. High five.
High five. High five.